Assalamu alaikum everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Pakistani Stories podcast. Today, I'm not going to take a lot of time in building up the whole podcast. We are directly going to jump into the podcast with Dennis and discuss cricket, all the controversies that are possible with India-Pakistan relations, to Wasim Akram's role in match fixing or the monkey gate, BCCI's role in international cricket. You can hear it all in the podcast, and I hope that you have a good time. Enjoy the podcast.
My name is Mansoor.
And so,
yeah. And my name is Imran, like the great Imran Khan.
He's not that great. Okay.
Come on. Okay. So today we are joined by Dennis Fredman. He's an Australian cricket journalist and host of Can't Bowl, Can't Throw cricket show. He's also very famous for cracking jokes about your favorite cricketers. So watch out. And for his unpopular opinions, some people know with the name of Bloody Gora, some with Dennis Does Cricket, some with Kala Jora Song. So welcome, Dennis, to the Pakistani podcast.
Thank you. Three things I need to correct. Okay. Number one, yeah, if you're going to have a guest on, you need to pronounce their surname properly.
Fredman.
So Fried. I know it's hard with the accent, but Friedman, like I'm free from something.
Okay, Friedman. Friedman. Okay.
Thank you. So that's number one. Number two, I'm the ex-host of the Can't Bowl, Can't Throw podcast. I did that for 6 years.
Okay.
With two amazing content creators in Kat Jones and Dan Leakey.
Mm-hmm.
And then I retired. So those two are still running the show. And what they did is they relaunched it. They called it season two.
Oh.
After 6 years, and it's much better now that I've left. So go and follow that one. And then the third thing you said is that I have unpopular opinions. I can tell you now, if my opinions were unpopular, no one would listen to them. I reckon they're just popular, but nobody wants to talk about them.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like, for example, you have a unpopular side, or you know, like.
Controversial
would be the right word, but I don't want to say the controversial word, so I
why
just
not
went
why are Pakistanis so afraid of controversy? I was having this chat the other day with, you know, Fazila Saba.
Yeah,
so something came up on Twitter and Faz wrote something about, you know, why are all these cricketers having controversy on Twitter now, you know, whether it be Shoaib Malik and Ramiz Raja,
yeah,
or Iqbal and Kaneria. And I said to Faz, I said, this is perfect. This is what we want. We want to see the real side of our cricket heroes and personalities, because they're just people. And she said, oh, no, we shouldn't have controversies. And I totally disagree with that view. And But I think Pakistanis are so scared of controversy or doing anything that might be seen as not proper that it goes into this death spiral where you avoid having proper debate.
Yeah.
About things, and you would rather call each other names or avoid something than actually have a sensible debate in a mature fashion, even if you disagree on something. You avoid having disagreements, and I don't understand why that's part of the culture.
Yeah,
it does
my
head in. It gives me the shits, because I even at the PSL, when I was there for the PSL and I wanted to talk about whether it be Shardjiel's return for Karachi Kings, if I was speaking to anyone at Karachi, they said, please don't ask me about Shardjiel. I'm like, well, what's the point? Like, if I can't have a debate with you, if I can't have a debate with you about things that the rest of the world are talking about and want to understand, and you can't, and you don't respect that your audience can understand the nuance, and the nuance might be with Shardjiel, you know what? He's just a fucking good batsman, and we think he's going to win us games, and I only care about winning games. Then just tell that story. If Salman Iqbal just said that, everyone goes, okay. But because he didn't want to talk about it, and no one wanted to talk about it, now you go, what are they hiding? Oh, Amir's there as well. Oh, and Wasim Akram's there as well. Oh, Dean Jones is there. And I know when Dean Jones first came to the PSL to coach, there were a lot of senior people going, oh, I'm not sure we should have Dean, because there was question marks about whether he was on the take back in the day. So, like, it snowballs into something worse, because you don't have the courage to just talk about it in the first place. So please talk about controversy, because it's the best thing you can ever do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there will be plenty of content about controversy in this podcast. So we have you.
All right. Shalom, Johnny. Shalom, Johnny.
So how would you compare the 90s era quality cricket to modern day cricket? Oh. Because when we see 90s cricket, it brings a lot of nostalgic feelings, you know?
Of course.
And are we reliving it, reliving the past? Or is it like the cricket is, cricket was actually better back then?
Everything was always better in the past, right?
Yeah.
It seems like that.
You know? Your body shape was better 5 years ago. Your girlfriends were better 5 years ago. Your mum's cooking was better 5 years ago. The city that you live in was safer 5 years ago. Everything was better 5 years ago. It's just how we are as humans. So the only thing that was better in the 90s in cricket was the fact that I think batsmen were braver because a lot of them didn't bat with helmets and they were facing some ridiculous bowlers, right? Kirtley Ambrose, Alan Donald, these kind of guys. So you had that. That's the only thing that was better. Nothing else was better. The pitches weren't better. The grounds weren't better. The facilities weren't better. The coaching wasn't better. The media broadcasting wasn't better. The money wasn't better. The quality of play wasn't better. The bats weren't better. The equipment weren't better. The engagement with fans wasn't better. Nothing else was better. Just there was probably 20 guys around the world who were just fucking cowboys and just went out like Viv Richards and Dean Jones and would face these guys at 150 miles an hour with no helmets and shit bats. That's probably the only thing that was better. Up and there was no boundary ropes. You used to have to slide into the fence and break your kneecap. That was better.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very interesting take. Yeah. I wasn't expecting that.
For us, I think the bowling was also better, no?
Like... No, it wasn't. It wasn't. There's no way the bowling was better. It can't possibly be better. How can it be better? You had worse coaches. You had worse pitches. You had... it might have seemed better because the batsmen weren't... No one was full-time. No one was professional. So everyone that was playing was part-time. They weren't getting proper coaching. They probably had another job. Maybe they did a column in a newspaper, or maybe they were an accountant or a plumber or something. No one was full time. Mm-hmm. It was just starting to become professional. So, but logically, the cricket has to be better these days. And because if you're not better now, you don't get to play because the stats and all these things like Hawkeye and CricViz, you can't hide anymore. So if you're not putting the ball in the spot where the coach wants to put the ball, you don't play the next match. So everything is, you can't live off reputation anymore. So it has to be better these days, just by logic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. So moving on, I think a lot of guys might be interested, and you might have answered that question already, but it's very interesting for us to know, how did you become a fan of Pakistani cricket? Like, you know, we are a neighbor of this huge Indian glamour of cricket, and then you come along and you are like all over Pakistani cricket.
It wasn't just a moment in time. It was a bit of a journey, right? So as a kid, one of my first cricketing memories was Javed Miandad trying to hit Dennis Lilly with a bat at the Wacker, and Pakistan used to come out and have all these names and that you could never pronounce because there wasn't many Pakistanis in Australia. So it was all a big mystery.
Right.
Who the fuck is Abdul Qadir? Who the fuck is Waqar Yunus? Who the fuck is Shoaib Akhtar? Who the fuck is Imran Khan? What do you mean?
Right.
Last time he was here, his name was Yunus Yahana. Now he's what? Muhammad Yusuf. What? Like this is Pakistan for us, right? So you have all these crazy things going on, and and then guys like Shahid Afridi come, Syed Anwar, guys that just did things differently, and you played differently, and so that's where I had an interest. And then I think because Pakistan also had a reputation of being this place you don't want to go. It's radical Islam, it's unsafe, this and that, and so. I'm an adventurer, so when someone says that's dangerous, don't do it, I'm like, fuck it, let's go do it. So, so that's how the interest started. And then 2027, where it really peaked off, because 2016, 2017, I was writing for a lot of Indian newspapers and I had a deep interest in Indian cricket. And then I started seeing what the BCCI was doing with Pakistan and isolating them for economic reasons, for no other reasons, and I didn't like it. And then I met a guy called Emma Nakvi, who you probably know, and his writing got me entrenched in what Pakistani cricket was about, because he merged pop culture and writing in a way nobody else in the history of man has done. This guy's a genius. And so I slowly learned more and more. And then the semi-final of the Champions Trophy 2017, I was in a pub in Sydney with a friend, and Pakistan were playing England. And if you remember, Pakistan qualified eighth for that tournament out of eight places, and only qualified because they refused to play it.
Zimbabwe.
No, I think it was West Indies, wasn't it? Or Sri Lanka. They refused to
play. No, I think so. Zimbabwe.
They refused to play someone to qualify. So, like, again, this is real Pakistan coming out. So, and I tweeted to my fans, if Pakistan, I was drunk in the pub, and I tweeted, if Pakistan win this game, I'm going to come to, I win this tournament, I'm coming to Pakistan. And if you've seen the Dennis Does Pakistan documentary on YouTube, you can see the footage of me drunk in that pub singing Sweet Home Islamabad. Lord, I'm coming home to you. So I was so drunk. I was making up words to Pakistani cities, right? And to be honest, that's the most interesting thing to ever happen to Islamabad was me writing that song. So so you guys then won the final. You won the final. And someone said, Dennis, start a GoFundMe page because you have to come to Pakistan now. I thought, oh, shit, here we go. So I started the page. In 2 days, I raised $6,500 to fund the trip.
Wow.
And then Pakistan Cables, a big cable company in Pakistan, rang me up and said, here's some more money. How much do you need? Let's just fund the trip. And so they sponsored the trip. Crick and Jiff helped me with the trip. It was crowdsourced. We spent every single cent on airfares, accommodation, camera equipment, production. So I didn't make a cent out of it. It probably cost me $2,000 or $3,000, to be honest. But I came and we made the documentary. And when I landed, I knew nobody. I booked my tickets. It took me 14 weeks to get a visa. And when I landed, I just prayed to God that someone would fucking be there to pick me up because I didn't know anybody. And people were telling me on WhatsApp, yeah, Dennis will be there, we'll be there. And this is the funny bastard. So this guy from Crick and Jiff, his name's Haroon. That's all I'll say.
Okay.
And he comes up to me outside. I landed in Karachi. He comes up to me. He goes, sir, sir, can I take your bag? Sir, sir. And I'm like, oh, fuck, he's trying to scam me. No, you can't touch my bag. And he's trying to play that guy scamming me. And then I see about five guys about 10 meters away laughing their heads off because they'd set him up to try and pretend. And they filmed all this. So it was so funny. So they tried to play a joke on me from the start. I came. I spent 15 days in Pakistan. That time I spent 17 days during the PSL. In PSL 5, I spent 2.5 weeks PSL 3 in Dubai with the tournament. And just every time I go, I get to meet more people. I fall in love with the there's a lot to like about Pakistan. It's very much like Australians. You're always underdogs. Mm-hmm. You like laughing at yourselves. You're at your best when your back's against the wall. Nothing ever works, but it always does somehow. I don't know. I just like it. There's lots about the personality traits I like. And so, it also helps when Pakistan likes you back. So I've been lucky that for whatever reason, Pakistan's embraced some of my dumb stuff. And so we have a mutual respect of each other. Most of us do.
Right. Right. That's great. But how was, since you mentioned recently that you went for PSL 2020 as well, for 17 days, right?
Yeah.
What were the differences? How was the experience? And what were the differences that you noticed from your last tour?
From 2017 to 2020?
Yeah.
The safety issues, one, but it's different too. I felt more comfortable the second time because I'd already been before. So if I hadn't have been before, then I might have felt a bit different. But this time I felt the security was overdone. Last time I thought it was overdone. This time I thought it was very overdone. I don't know. This time it was just easier for me because I had a lot of friends that I'd made through my trip last time, both within the media and outside of the media. I try and get out of the cricket bubble as much as I can when I travel to places and just meet. Like this time I went to some random guy's house that invited me for dinner and I met his family. I can't remember what he did or what his name was, but I spent an evening with him because I just wanted, he asked me and I said, okay, why not? I'll get to meet some more people, learn some more things. I had a lot of friends here and I just felt more comfortable in my skin. I knew what I was doing. Last time I was still trying to feel my way around the country I've never been to. This time I knew exactly what I was doing.
This time your family was more supportive as well. Like you shared your story last time that the first time when you were coming to Pakistan, everyone said, no, it's not going to happen or it's not safe and all.
No, no, they weren't supportive again. They don't like me going.
That's brutal honesty.
Yeah, but for two reasons. One, it's February, right? So it's always in February your bloody tournament, and which is the last month of summer, which is holiday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Holiday season here. The kids are at home. They're not at school. So like, I'm giving up time with the family to do it. So there's that. There's always the risk, not so much a safety risk, but, you know, I need to make a living. So there's always a risk that maybe I won't get paid or something will go wrong. You just never know. So there's, yeah, it's just, there's that. And it's a long tour, you know, 17 days away when you've got three young kids to a place like Pakistan, where my wife's family and friends are going, Pakistan, what the fuck is in Pakistan? Get him out of there, quick. Someone call the embassy. You know, like...
But did you try to break these stigmas?
You tell me.
With your family, with your circle?
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, you can see what I'm doing to try and break the stigma.
Yeah.
It's all public. Of course I am.
Yeah.
No, within your family as well, because even if the second time they are not so much comfortable, apart from the holiday season, of course, that's one of the major reasons. But apart from that, you can convince them, you can show that, okay, it's safer, it's I'm having fun, it's a lot of fan following that you're, of course,
getting. My wife hates it more because she thinks I give more energy in Pakistan to the people there than I do to her when I come home. So... She watches all my videos and everything, and she says, how can you be so personable with them, and then, when you come home you just sit on the couch and you say nothing to me? So that's why she hates me.
Oh god. That's a really good one.
It's the truth. You think I'm making it up? It's the truth. I'll put her on now and I'll ask her.
There are a lot of people that can relate to that. That's what I'm trying to say. Imran.
Moving forward, I wanted to ask, like, what are the big major takeaways from PSL and from your trip to Pakistan? What can improve? What can go right? What was wrong, or anything, like, you know, as a neutral observer?
I think most of it was positive. What people forget is that you've had no cricket for 10 years of any real substance, right? Yes, you had the World 11 or you had a Zimbabwe or whatever, but that's just a one-off match or two matches. But when you haven't had cricket tours for 10 years, you lose so much skills and knowledge. So how do you, for example, how do you handle logistics? How do you deal with the hotels? How do you deal with security? How do you deal with ticketing? How do you deal with broadcasting? How do you deal with catering the fans? How do you deal with getting the fans in and out of grounds? How do you deal with the broadcast rights? How do you sell the media? All these things that are required to put on a tour are magnified when you're doing a fast-paced T20 tournament. And none of those skills existed in Pakistan. And the fact that the tournament went off without a hitch, except for the opening ceremony, which was absolutely shit. Everything else went perfectly. There was no security incidents. All the players got to where they wanted to go. No one went home. None of the players went home early, except for COVID, and that's understandable. You know, the pitches were good. The grounds were excellent. The grounds were full. People got to the grounds and people got out of the grounds. There were no fights in the stands. Yeah. There were plenty of females in the grounds. The broadcast on TV was good. The digital rights by Crick and Jiff were done excellently. There was 36 or something international players. There was another 8 or so international broadcasters. You even convinced Erin Holland to come because her husband was coming. Like, fuck, everything went right.
The only thing that really wrecked it
was this bloody virus. Apart from that, it was everyone was behind it. It was probably reminded me of season 2 or 3 of the Big Bash, where it finally got its rhythm and everyone understood it and everyone in Australia was behind it. Whereas every single person in Pakistan had an opinion on the PSL. And trust me, I was lucky. I wasn't, you know, all the players and all the PCB guests were stuck in hotels because they were guests of the state. I wasn't a PCB guest. I was a guest of two of the teams. So I got to go. I was free to roam. And I was going out into, you know, I went into Burns Road in Karachi, and I went to Liberty Chowk in Lahore, and I went to the streets in Multan, and I just ate in the streets and talked to people in the streets, and everybody had an opinion on PSL. The whole country was there behind it. It was amazing. The vibe was amazing.
Yeah,
that's great. That's great to hear. Which one was your favorite match and why?
I don't know. I didn't watch a match from beginning to end because I was too busy trying to make content. So you get lost.
Okay, let's say in terms of atmosphere, Pindi, Multan, Karachi,
Multan
Lahore.
By a mile.
Okay.
Think about it this way.
Yeah.
Think about it this way. Think you and all your family and all your friends. So yeah. Take your 20 closest friends and 50 of your closest family, and you can't eat biryani mm-hmm. for 10 years. And then I say, mm-hmm. I'm going to bring the best biryani in the world to your house, and we're going to eat it for 2 weeks every night, and mm-hmm. I'm going to cook it specially for you. That's what it was like at Multan. No one had seen cricket for 10 years, and then they brought Shahid mm-hmm. Afridi and Shane Watson and Jason Roy and Cammy Akmal, and everybody just came to this town, and
together.
Bang!
Yeah.
And it just blew up. It was amazing. And to be honest, they've got a wonderful owner at Multan with Ali Khan Tareen. He does a beautiful job of promoting mm-hmm. the young kids, of making sure that his team is engaged with the local South Punjabi community. It just worked beautifully. So Multan by a mile, and it was so loud and passionate. I loved it. Loved it.
Great. Okay, moving on from PSL, because I think so. We have talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
Because we talk about Wasim Akram, I read the article that you wrote about Wasim, the difficult relationship with Wasim Akram. I wanted to ask, what should have been the ideal punishment for Wasim Akram and co? Because he wasn't alone, of course, in the 90s. So that we could have avoided 2010 or more incidents.
This is a big... There's no easy answer to this. So... what you're referring to is an article I wrote for Dawn in 2017 called My Difficult Relationship with Wasim Akram. And what the story was about, it started off talking about... See, look, the police are coming to find me now. Wasim's already called them. what it started talking about was...
Perfect timing.
How the article... If you haven't read the article, the first half of it is about me watching Wasim Akram bowl in Hobart the first over of a test match the month later. And me falling in love with this guy called Wasim Akram. The second half of the article is me pulling apart the Kaim report from 2000 and forensically going back into there and understanding what that was about. And that report, there's a lot of youngsters who weren't even born in 2000 when this report came out, which talked about Kaim was a Supreme Court judge who was asked by the army at that point in time who were running the country in the PCB to investigate match fixing on the behest of the ICC, who said this was getting ridiculous. And he did. And Kaim has his knockers because there's some who say he was corrupt and this and that. But the one thing about the Kaim report that is not up for debate is that the evidence that it presents was never challenged by anybody. What was challenged was the punishments. So if you park the punishments, the evidence speaks for itself. Now, the evidence is objective. You can then take a subjective view of what the punishment should be. So it's no different to someone who goes to court and they're found guilty of manslaughter and you go, okay, the facts are he committed manslaughter. What the punishment is a subjective thing. Depends on the judge and all kinds of things, right? So Wasim, in the published report, and I say the published report because I have seen the original documents and I have copies of other documents that show that there was an original Kaim report that got edited at the behest of what was then, I can't remember what it was called then, I have to get my notes. But you know how the CIB Investigation Bureau? What's the Anti-Corruption Bureau? CAB.
FIA?
CAB.
Oh, okay.
Is it CAB? Yeah, okay. CAB. So whatever the precursor of CAB was, there was an investigator there by the name of Adam Khan. And he produced, he now lives in the USA and he refuses to talk to me. I've tried to interview him many times and he produced a body of evidence that he presented to the president of the PCB at that time and also some other people. And I've published this letter that was the cover note. I've put up on Twitter and Facebook and it basically says, "Dear sirs, here's the evidence. Do with it what you like. I suggest you throw it all in the trash can." And inside that document, or that body of documents, which I have read and I have copies of some of it, is I won't say exactly, but I'll just say there is proof of fixing by people that are named in that Kaim report. If you read the Kaim report, and let's talk about Wasim because you named him. Wasim, things that aren't up for debate. Wasim Akram was accused by Adda al-Rahman of fixing. Wazim Akram then paid Adda al-Rahman to fly to London to meet Wazim's lawyer and change his testimony. So Wazim paid with his own credit card for the guy that accused him to perjure himself. Right? Which, if you did that in a court of law, you would be locked up for witness tampering. Wazim was then, in the published crime report, fined 30,000 rupees and banned from being captain for life. Now, you don't pay a fine, you don't get banned if you haven't done something, right? So, and also in the crime report, the burden of proof was not like a court. The burden of proof was much higher. So therefore, to get a fine means there was clearly something going on. Now, I can tell you there was stuff that happened, but I can't tell you what, because then I open myself up to some things and then I need to publish some things, and I'm saving that for another day. So, but Wazim is just one, as you rightly said. Salim Malik took the fall. Qayyum came out later many years ago, maybe 3 years ago or 2 years ago, and said, you know, back in the day, I had a soft spot for Wazim, so I didn't go as hard as I should have. The truth of the matter is, he was told to change his punishments for Wazim Akram. Imran Khan also came out and said that he would look after some of these guys and it won't happen again. Fast forward 2017, and Shargeel is fixing the PSL. 2018. Mm-hmm. 2017, 2018. Shargeel's fixing the PSL when Wazim Akram is the team manager of that team. You tell me if there's a connection. I don't know, but it has a smell. But if, and at the time, the ACB is no different with Mark Warren, Shane Warne, right? Because in South Africa, we also had the King Report, which was about Hansie Cronje and what he was doing with Azzeruddin and a whole lot of other guys. There was Kiwis involved, and let's not name any more names. But what I'll say, if the game was serious back in those days, you would ban them for life, irrespective, and they're gone. Amir, Asif, Butt should have been banned from life from playing any representative cricket, and you wouldn't have these things happening. You would not have these things happening. You would not have guys like Nasir Jamshed being locked up in jail because trying to fix a T10 tournament just last year, right? This stuff, you wouldn't have it. So what's happening at the moment is you've got the PCB now saying publicly, we want to get some laws put in place to make match fixing a crime. In England, match fixing is a crime. You get locked up. So people aren't fixing matches except for Pakistanis because they're stupid in England, right? So you don't see English people fixing matches in England because you go to fucking jail. So they need to do the same in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Once that happens, everything calms down. That's part A. The other part is you need strong leadership that just removes these guys who were tainted and have been named in the crime report from anything to do with Pakistani cricket. And those names include Wazim Akram, Inzamam Al-Haq. They're all there. You can read the names yourself. Just remove them from the game. Remove Amir from the game. Get rid of them. Shargeel, sorry, we've changed their mind. You're not playing anymore. Let them be sued. Go to court. Pay them out. Get rid of them. Because as soon as cricket shows that if you take a shit on it and it will still take you back, then you've just sold your soul, because the only person that wins from that is the match fixer. The players don't win. Nobody else wins. The guy that Shargeel kept out of a T20 place in Karachi Kings doesn't win. It's just fucking ridiculous. Cricket is not society. In society, if you go to jail, when you come out of jail, we need to put you somewhere. You need to have the right to work and do things. Otherwise, you become homeless on the street. But if you take a shit on cricket, when you come back from your ban, cricket doesn't owe you a thing. You can go get another job. Go play another fucking sport. Go find another occupation. People lose their jobs all the time in all types of occupations. People get made redundant. People get all kinds of things. Why should cricketers who take a shit on cricket be treated any differently to the rest of society because they're a name and they're famous? Pakistan has a problem, as does India, because they hero worship, and they have to stop hero worshipping and hold these people to account. You forget it. In India, we had the Mughal report back in 2015 with the secret envelope where a Supreme Court justice put in an envelope that was sealed with 13 names in it to the Supreme Court and said, these 13 people need to be investigated. There's names in there that would make the hair fall out of your head if India and the BCCI at the time had the balls to release those names. The only guy in India that's ever had the balls to call names is Lalit Modi when he banned Chris Cairns from the IPL because he got word that the guy was trying to fix matches.
That's interesting. Wow. That's interesting. Actually, I had a follow-up question, but I will skip that because your answer was very comprehensive.
And the problem that I've got is this view that I'm expressing is not an unpopular view, but it's a view that no one wants to talk about because no one wants to be seen as the guy that's taking on Wazim Akram because he's such a big name. Nobody wants to be seen as the guy that's taking on the PCB because the PCB allowed Amir back and they've allowed Shajil back, and now Wazim Akram's on the cricket committee. This is an institutional problem that can only be fixed by the PCB by playing zero tolerance. I interviewed Najim Sethi in 2017. And I said, Najim, you said zero tolerance, yet you prosecuted for Amir to come back into the team. Why? And he goes, oh, he served his time. He said, no, that's not zero tolerance. That's zero tolerance for a period of time, and now I'm giving you another chance. It's not about second chances. Cricket gives nobody second chances. If you debut, you worked your ass off for 15 years in the first-class system, you debut and make a golden duck and never get picked again, where's your second chance?
Yeah. That's true. But Imran.
There's this follow-up question that Yavu hero worship and everything, but there were another group of players who were standing up against this fixing culture in the 1990s, like Rashid Latif, Amir Sohail. Why did not they get the respect
they deserve? Because two things. One is, at the time, again, the army was running the country and this was seen as negative towards the perception of Pakistan. So they tried to silence these guys and so they wouldn't be bringing negative things to Pakistan, because the only thing that was bringing positivity to Pakistan was the hockey team and the cricket team. So you've got this political influence. And again, this hero worship, it goes on now. I struggle with how people want to be associated with these guys to this day. There's an old saying that says decision making is easy when you know what your values are. And I once interviewed a very senior person at Islamabad United when Wazim was there, straight after the Shajil thing happened. And I said to him, how do you balance up working with this guy when you know all this stuff? And he looked me in the eye and he said, I know all this stuff. I know it's wrong, but it's Wazim. And so the hero worship thing kicks in. And then people will say to me, oh, yeah, but what about Mark Waugh? What about Shane Warne? Mark Waugh and Shane Warne have never been found guilty of doing anything other than being fucking stupid and taking a couple of $100 to give some pitch information, right? There is no body of evidence against these guys and pages of court documents that say here's what they did, apart from being just stupid.
Okay.
But still, Mark Waugh went on and became a national selector for Australia. And I'm like, how the hell does that happen? Rod Marsh was the chairman of the selectors of Australia for a long time. Rod Marsh bet against his own team in the Ashes, and then they lost the match. And this ridiculous things, right? Anyhow.
Yeah, but the same thing applies for Smith and Warner. Don't you think so? Because you go on, we can see. No? How is
very
that different?
So Smith and Warner, Faf du Plessis, Sachin Tendulkar, all these people that tampered with the ball or had one too many people outside the inner circle and didn't get caught with a no ball or something, or claimed a catch when it wasn't a catch, they're twisting the rule to try and help their team win a cricket match. Amir, Asif, Wazim, all these guys, they put money in their pocket for their own good to try and help their team be worse off in a cricket match. And so they're very, very different. When you're trying to help your team improve, now cheating, if no one twisted the rules, you wouldn't need umpires, right? So you have umpires because people always try and twist the rules as much as they can to their advantage to try and help their team win. What we're talking about with match fixing and spot fixing is the opposite. It's about helping, doing something negative against your team for your own good, for your own pocket. Nobody, when Amir overstepped the and made those no balls, what happens? There's runs given away. There's opportunities for wickets that can't happen because they're no balls, and he puts money in his pocket. How does the Pakistan team get better for that? No one's better. When Warner puts sandpaper on the ball and maybe they get three wickets because the ball swings some more, the whole team wins. So I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but you can't compare ball tampering or trying to cheat for advantage versus fixing for disadvantage and lining your pockets with money. They're very different things.
That's a valid argument. Also, I also think that somehow the reaction to Warner and Stephen Smith was blown out because every every act of ball tampering is
And after that, the ICC said, shit, we've got a problem. We better make this a four-match penalty now and this and that, okay, because they don't want it to happen. But, you know, no one looks at Faf du Plessis, Paulie. He rubbed mints on the ball and he rubbed the ball against the zipper in two different matches and got fined twice. Sachin Tendulkar ball tampered.
Yeah.
Shahid Afridi put the Shahid Afridi tried to eat the fucking ball.
Yeah, he started eating.
But you gonna tell me because Shahid Afridi bit the ball that he's in the same as Shargeel? Shahid Afridi, you're correct.
No.
Shahid Afridi didn't take money to try and twist a tournament. Shahid Afridi tried to bite some leather off the ball so the ball would do some more things so that Pakistan could win a match. Very, very different.
Point
taken. Yeah. Imran has a very interesting counter.
Yeah, there's like it's moving towards the contemporary, let's say, last 10 years and so on. What's been happening to the sport? There is, like, I still remember the Border Gavaskar Monkey Gate scandal, and it's always like fascinating for me to feel how does as an Australian how you feel that perhaps the legacy of Australian cricket got undermined somehow by perhaps the monetary hegemony of Indian.
So we're talking
cricket.
About Monkey Gate. I've got a very interesting story about Monkey Gate. So I spoke to Mike Proctor.
Yeah.
I interviewed Mike Proctor, and that podcast is still up on my stream somewhere years ago. And Mike Proctor was the match referee in that match. And so we asked him about what happened. And so let's remind your listeners of what happened in that match. So Harbhajan got accused of calling Andrew Symonds a monkey. Harbhajan gave evidence and said he didn't do it. And also at the time, to Mike Proctor, Mike Proctor interviewed all the players. And Sachin Tendulkar said he didn't hear anything. 2 weeks later, on appeal, because he got fined and banned, remember, Harbhajan, and they threatened to remove to go home. BCCI cracked the shits and said, "Well, we're going to go home. We're going to we're going to do a Sonny Gavaskar and just walk off the pitch because we're a bunch of dickheads." So they got a New Zealand High Court judge to be an independent arbiter, and the New Zealand High Court judge asked Sachin Tendulkar, "What did you hear?" And on record, Sachin has already told Mike Proctor, "I heard nothing." And Sachin said, "Oh no, no," he said, "Teramaki." Right? So Sachin perjured himself in front of a New Zealand High Court judge, the highest court of the land, to try and save his friend's skin on the back of the BCCI threatening to leave the tour, on the back of Cricket Australia then getting scared that they would lose money, and they engineered this bloody outcome so that everyone... Andrew Symonds is still, to this day, shitty about that outcome and how Cricket Australia followed the money rather than sticking up for what was right. And I come back to the saying, if you know what your values are, decision-making is easy. If Cricket Australia had said, no, this is wrong, we need to make a stand against this kind of shit, fuck it. If the BCCI leave, that's on them. We can find a way through. But they didn't. They said, shit, we need to protect the revenues here. There's too many dollars at stake. Let's orchestrate a way for Sachin to say something to somebody else and make some lies and everything will go away. That's what happened.
Yeah. That's true. Moving on to another statement from Michael Clarke. You must have heard he said that Australian cricketers sucked up to Kohli to save IPL deals. What's the scenario in the country right now? Do they feel really that that is how the Australian cricketer sucked up, or is it like just one of the things where Michael Clarke want to get into the
No one takes Michael Clarke seriously because he's a really bad commentator. He's a shit bloke. he was a great batsman, but he wasn't that popular in the team. He was Shane Warne's little boy, and he's a really bad commentator. You gotta remember, Michael Clarke created a massive furor when Mike Hussey retired. Simon Cadish put his arm around Clarke's throat because Michael Clarke wanted to hurry up and get out of the changing rooms and go on some party. And Michael Clarke left a tour of New Zealand to break up with his girlfriend, right? So he's not seen as a team player.
Right.
He's seen as an individualist. He's not that – I wouldn't say he's highly respected as a person in Australia, cricket scene generally. He's respected as a batsman, but maybe not as a person. So, but the other thing about Australians is if Michael Clarke said it, people probably go, yeah, probably happened with some cases. I'm sure it happened in some cases. It's only human nature. I'm sure those people that were big weren't big enough names to know that they were going to get drafted probably had second thoughts about going after Colley. I'm sure there was a couple. I'm sure it happened. Yeah. Mate, Colley got Harsha Bogan.
Okay.
Colley got Ravi Shastri into the coaching job after Shastri didn't even apply in the process. And then the process shut. And then Colley said, nah, Ravi has to be in the process. So they reopened the process at the behest of Hessen and Tom Moody. And then he and Dhoni got bloody Harsha Bogan kicked out of the bloody commentary box because he said some shit about Dhoni. Like, this is the power these guys have. And again, the BCCI, this is when Thakur was president. But this is, you know, they've got too much power. The individual should never be more important than the game. That's what happens over there at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. But moving on to the same line of questions, like why wasn't Australia? Because we see the effect of IPL on the global scenario right now. And you talk about Big Bash and how Kerry Packer started and revolutionized cricket and brought money to the game. Why wasn't Australia able to develop the premium brand of cricket like IPL?
Australians don't really give a shit about cricket except for summer. So for 8 weeks of the year, cricket's on TV. It's kind of there. We're not that passionate about it. We're passionate about football.
Mm-hmm.
So and I'll give an example. Australia only has 25 million people. Only half of the country plays Australian rules football.
Mm-hmm.
Yet on the global scene, the crowd average to an Australian rules football match is the third highest in the world. Right? So people care about football. They don't care about cricket so much. Whereas in India, Pakistan, whatnot, everyone cares about cricket first. So cricket's not the main sport through the whole year in Australia. It dominates for maybe 6 or 8 weeks through December, January, but then it sort of dies off. And no one, like 2 years ago, Australia went to Sri Lanka and lost a series 3-0 and no one even knew. So,
correct. Unless you're not losing at home, it's all fine, yeah?
Oh, that's interesting. Or ashes.
But that's it. You know, even the tours of India are on pay TV. And in Australia, so to give you an understanding, only 30% of the Australian population have pay TV. And of that, how many do you think have it because of cricket? Not that many. So, like, when we went to India last time, it wasn't not many people get to see it. And if it's not on your TV screens, no one cares because it's out of sight, out of mind. And then you read the paper. Oh,
wonderful
in India. Oh, that's interesting. True. Great. And then you get on with your life because during between March and September in Australia, it's football season. So everybody's football is dominating. It's like PSL. Mm-hmm. It just dominates everything. So you've got no chance. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to run a hockey tournament when the PSL is on, good luck getting any media coverage, right? So that's what cricket's like during the football seasons.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's really interesting because I thought cricket is super, super famous in popular in Australia. Like, you produce the
cricket. But people say to me, I mean, people accuse me, oh, Dennis, you know, you're not that big in Australia. And I go, no, name five big cricket journalists in Australia. They don't exist because cricket's not that it's not that big, right? Okay, and take away ex-players, right? So ex-players don't count. You can't say Richie Benno or Ricky Ponting or something. Name me five Australian cricket journalists. People can't do it.
Mm.
Right? It's not a thing. Yeah. So the market for me is not in Australia.
Yeah. Well, that's how you connect with us.
I focused on India first because I was intrigued with India, but then you guys are just more fun. And you guys are much more interesting. And also, when I started coming to Pakistan, no Goras were coming to Pakistan. Now all the Goras are coming. And so I've lost everyone else has discovered you guys. So it's not as fun for me anymore. It was much more fun in the past when everyone said, Pakistan, you're a fucking idiot. What are you doing that for? Now everyone's going, Pakistan, how cool is that place? So...
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Imran, next one is up.
Yeah, I think like staying in this IPL BCCI thing, like recently we have this thing that IPL will be replacing Asia Cup, and like this is so bad. Like for me, it's bad because it's like India has kidnapped the game What are your comments about it? Like, you know, this relationship between
the problem and is ICC. Asia comes on an ICC tournament. It's an Asia, it's an Asian tournament, right?
So
And that league's dominated by BCCI. So BCCI will say, "Here you go, Afghanistan. Here's $3 million," and they'll go, "Here you go, Sri Lanka. Here's $5 million," and they just won't give a shit. The Asia Cup is dead. Like it, it's.
But don't you think it would demean the international cricket?
As I said, the difference is IPL is dominated and done for money, and like the BCCI's responsibility to grow the game outside of India, they don't give a shit about. And this is the problem when you have independent boards. And the ICC is run by board representatives from all the different countries. Until the ICC is independent of the cricket countries. So I'll give you an example. New Zealand and Australia both have independent boards, right? So Cricket Australia has nine directors. Yeah. None of them are members of the state bodies. So when they make a decision, the states can yell and scream, but they have no power. In England, the ECB has an equal voting by all the 18 counties. So you have all these factions and the counties fighting each other, and they're all in it for themselves. There's self-interest to make money. Mm. BCCI is the same. So until you have, and the ICC is the same, but until you have independent directors, you won't get things done for the best interests of the game and for the fans, which is us. You'll get best interest for what can make more cash, which is a ridiculous thing, because if you just keep making cash all the time and lose sight of the fact you need to grow the game and make it more popular, and the more popular you make it, the more sustainable it is, then one day something's going to go wrong and it'll fall over.
That's true.
I wanted to ask, there's this question like we received. What's your opinion about all this matter about Daryl Hare? And his what he has up against like the Asian teams.
Daryl Hare.
Yeah, the Australian Empire.
The Empire that given the Murli episode and the Oval Test in England for 2006 or so, where
he was doing his job with Murli at the time. The rules said, if in the opinion of the umpire you bend your arm, it's a no ball. And he and Emerson, two Australian umpires, both called it. And again, this is about having the balls to do it. Just because they didn't do it in Asia. No one's ever going to call it in Asia because they want Murli because he brings people in the gate, whatever. In England, it was about ball tampering. And I tell you now, I guarantee, I don't know, but I guarantee that the Pakistan team was ball tampering. I had Waqar Yunus on an Instagram. I had Waqar Yunus it's an easy thing to say, because Waqar Yunus was on my Instagram Live last week. And essentially acknowledged everyone used to do it. They used bottle tops.
Okay.
There's footage of Imran Khan giving an interview in the 80s on the BBC saying, "Yes, we all used to do it, but we thought it was normal." They were fucking doing it. I know of stories of the Pakistani team in the West Indies would have pre-prepared balls that were already scuffed up, sitting underneath the covers on certain parts of the ground on the boundary, and they'd pay the ball boys. And when the ball went that way, the ball boy would swap the balls, and all of a sudden reverse swing happened. Like, I guarantee that ball.
That is a master plan
that Daryl Hare called. There was ball tampering going on. I guarantee it 100%. The guy just had the nuts. The guy just had nuts, and he was able to call it. But most umpires just go, "We'll stay out of the limelight."
Yeah. Yeah, but in the case of Murli, there was even an occasion where he bowled a leg break and they called him still.
Yeah, but doesn't matter. Remember what the rules were. The rules are if in the opinion of the umpire. So if the umpire thinks in his head, he's human, this is what I'm seeing with his own eyes. He doesn't have the ability to, in his mind, to put someone in a lab and fucking put wires on them and measure their angles. He's looking at it and he's going, fuck, he's chucking it. He's calling a chuck. That's it. And to be fair, thank Christ they did, because what happened on the back of that? We cleaned out all the chucking. You've got to remember all the people that were chucking that got cleaned up for 2 or 3 years after that. We clarified the rules about what chucking is. We set up labs that could actually properly measure it objectively so there was no more subjectiveness in it. We set up protocols on how you get banned or not banned and how to come back from if you're throwing it. If we hadn't done that, guys like Hafeez would never be playing anymore.
Okay, yeah, that's a
positive way to look at it. Yeah,
Yeah, that's very optimistic of you. India-Pakistan. Just a quick question on India-Pakistan. Yuvraj and Harbhajan, if you follow them on Twitter, showed support via Twitter to Shahid Afridi. But lately, they had to release a statement clarifying their nationalism to extend that Harbhajan posted a video of hitting Shoaib Akhtar for a six, translating into "do not mess." How do you evaluate India?
While the BJP is there and while Modi is there, the place is broken. And then you have the politics of the pressure of guys like Harbhajan and Yuvraj having to come out because there must be immense pressure on them from the BJP and the BCCI not to be showing anything other than nationalism towards India. And this is causing it's shit. Mm-hmm. It's horrible stuff. Just from a human perspective, it's horrible. Look what's going on in Kashmir. It's just horrible. Look what's going on in Assam. It's horrible. Whereas the opposite is happening in Pakistan. You're opening up the corridor mm-hmm. to that Sikh temple. You send back Abinandan and you say, "Here, have a cup of tea," and you send him home safe to his family mm-hmm. and say, "Just don't come again. Stop mm-hmm. fucking around. We haven't got time for this shit." If India's in there spouting hate, you've got bloody BJP ministers getting on there saying Muslims, if there's more than 30% of Muslims in an area, then the whole place turns to shit. And like, what is this crap? I don't understand. I don't get it. And we've seen it before. We've seen it before with the Nazis. So that doesn't mean I hate India. It doesn't mean I hate India. I've just got a problem with... I've got a problem.
Yeah, there's a difference. Institutions. Yeah.
One is the BJP and Modi, and the other one is the BCCI. It's institutional problems I have. There's a lot of good people in both those things, I'm sure. Yeah. But overall, at the moment, they're acting like a bunch of absolute fuckwits. And as I said, at some stage, Modi won't be there and the tide will turn, and it might take 5 years, 10 years, whatever. But I just can't wait till it happens because when I lived in India back and forth in 04 and 05, and it was an amazing place, and we had none of this bullshit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another fan question that I want to take. He asked us, do you think Dhoni is rightly given the credit for 2011 World Cup, especially for the innings he played in the final, given the Gambhir batted one down and he scored 97. Now I understand you have a difficult relationship with Gambhir, that I know. But given just if you look at the final, do you think it was rightly given?
Yeah, but back in those days, the BCCI...
He was the man of the
2014, the BCCI gave Dhoni a man of the match award in an ODI where he made 12 runs. And when questioned about it afterwards, they said, "Oh, he's been out of form and we want to help improve his spirit." So we made him man of the match. That's the logic in India, right? So that's a fact. Dhoni man of the match, undeserved. You'll find the articles. It was in 2014, I think, where he in an ODI match. I don't know. I'd need to go and watch the match again. I couldn't give a shit about the 2011 World Cup final, so I don't care.
Okay, not the answer that he was expecting, but I think so. You should make him happy. Coming to the upcoming tours, Australia hasn't toured Pakistan since 1998. Yeah, with the current FTP, Australia is scheduled to tour Pakistan in 2023, I guess. And I wanted to know, what do you think 100%. Pakistan is ready to
host
them?
You've just hosted 36 international players, all the international coaches, all the international journalists. Without a hitch, it works. You can do it. You've proven you can do it. Mm-hmm. Australia and England are very close to coming. In the next 5 years, you'll see them there.
And will Australia come? Because Australia did not used to tour even before, like after 1997, they did not used to tour Pakistan.
Well, 1996, they didn't even go to Pakistan for the World Cup matches, if you remember rightly, right? So they forfeited, I think, two matches and they didn't get their points. They were only playing in India and Sri Lanka. So, and they still made the final.
Yeah. Almost.
But you got to remember, this is, and I've had this debate, that Pakistan has had traditionally a really bad reputation in the Western media as a place that's full of fucking crazy Islamic terrorists and bombs going off and all this shit. And there's parts of Pakistan that still have bombs going off. If you go to Quetta or you go Balochistan, there's stuff going on, right? But on the east side of the country, it's as safe as anywhere. But when you've got that reputation... And when your main stadium is named after a guy called Colonel Gaddafi, who blew a passenger airline out of the sky over the UK, and you wonder why you've got a perception problem.
Yeah.
Like for fuck's sake, change the name of that stadium, please. Because people go, people ask me, Gaddafi Stadium, is that named after Colonel Gaddafi? I go, yeah. Go, oh, fuck, I'm not going there. Like that's a. And then, but then I get this nationalist bullshit. Oh, you don't know what he did for Pakistan. I know what he did for Pakistan. He stood at that stadium and he said Pakistan should have self-respect and should have the nuclear bomb and bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. It was fucking 40, 50 years ago. Move on with the world. Those days are gone. You've got the bomb. No one's going to fuck with you. Just if you want to change the perceptions, then do some of that stuff. And then they go to me, oh, what about Winston Churchill? Well, I'm Australian. There's no Winston Churchill statues in my country. So, and I don't think Australia. So you know, you've got to help. There's many ways you've got to change perceptions, and the only way is not just by saying by cricketers going it safe. You need to. There's all the other things around the edges. You've got to think broad.
Yeah.
Right. Perfect.
Moving on, like staying on the same topic. Like, do you think like Pakistan is bidding for the ICC proposed tournament from like 2023 to 2031 and hoping to host like at least two events of ICC? Do you think it will be also be possible like an ICC event? Or and how should like what's the deal with ICC and this big three? Like, how should they deal? Like, Pakistan is also a huge market.
Well, the big three is gone. So, and that was broken up by an Indian, Shashank Manohar, who's the head of the ICC, is the guy that blew that up. So he needs a, they should build a statue to him. They should name, Gaddafi Stadium, Manohar Stadium, because he's the guy that saved. That would fucking be awesome. name it Sachin Tendulkar Stadium.
That's a fucking great idea.
Name it Virat Kohli Stadium. Pakistan can't host any ICC tournament until it can prove that it can run its own full T20 tournament over 4, 5, 6 years. And that means multiple stadiums. So you need Peshawar, Quetta, Faisalabad, Hyderabad, wherever you want to play, Abbottabad, I don't care. But you need more than just three stadiums to host. And you need to do it for 3 or 4 years before you can even think about it. And you need some tours from England, South Africa, Australia before anyone, it's even going to work. And then even then it won't work because if the BCCI won't come and play there, then it won't happen. The ICC won't allow it to happen.
But they just sent their Kabaddi team to Pakistan.
Yeah, but of course they did.
And nobody noticed in India.
There. But
did you see that?
Cricket is used for political reasons. So until that happens, until that nexus is broken, then you can't. Like logically, it can't happen.
But how absurd as a neutral, how absurd do you find this BCCI's argument that we will not play cricket? Like, even if we are sending, like, we are not like, you know, but, you know, even if we are sending terrorists over to India, like, how stupid an argument that they are sending
it's
terrorists.
It's not an argument.
You're
mistaken because it's not an argument. They're just giving you some propaganda. The reason it's not happening is because of economic terrorism.
Yeah.
The reason they're telling you is because of some safety or political means, or they say, oh, we need approval from the government, which is the great one, because they can hide behind whatever they want. But that's not the facts. The facts is the government don't want them to do it, so therefore the BCCI have to come up with a story, and they just come up with a story. That's it.
That's true. I think so. We have covered most of the questions, right? Almost all. Right?
Yeah, that we could like look into. Like, it was really nice to get this opinion. Like, for example, there's one last comment for me. Like, I have one last thing I want to ask. Why did you say that Imran was not so that great? Like, you know,
he's still stuck. When we started the conversation, Dennis. So
the only reason Imran is prime minister is because he won the Women's World Cup, right? You voted for him because of that, right?
We voted for him for other reasons, but not
politics. Let me tell you this.
As a cricket Great.
Yeah, he was an amazing cricketer. There was one stage in his career he averaged over 50 with the bat and under 20 with the ball, which we'll never see again and we've never seen before. But when I interviewed him in 2017 at Barney Gallagher in his house, and we turned up with maybe six or seven people. Whenever I went to an interview, I went to Misbah's house, one person would come. When I said I'm going to Imran's house, every man and his dog wanted to come on the bus. So, and I didn't care. Like, it's Imran, like, whatever. I just saw him as a politician, getting ready to be a politician, and I found it a very easy interview. I found Misbah the hardest interview I've done in my life, and I was so nervous to interview him because he's got these steely eyes. But then, if you watch Dennis Does Pakistan at the end of it, I interview Imran and he says, I was talking about Sikandar Bhatt, and he goes, oh, Sikandar, he's got a lot of views, but pity he wasn't that good a cricketer. So, therefore, when people talk about Imran, I go, yeah, he wasn't that good a cricketer.
And that brings us to the end of the podcast. First of all, we'd like to thank Dennis for taking out the time and coming on the show. And honestly, he was so candid as he can be. It was very straightforward. He talked about everything and anything that we asked him. So thank you so much, Dennis. The second credit, I'd like to say thanks to my wife because she was the one who kept sending these live requests to Dennis. And eventually, I got to talk to him and ask him on the podcast. Secondly, I would also like to thank you people because you were also a part of it while commenting on his photos, asking him, reminding him about the podcast, and it finally happened. So thank you all. And if you haven't listened to our previous episodes, please go ahead, listen to them, share your feedback on your choice of social media, and we look forward to hearing from you. And until next time, Allah Hafiz.